This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Thursday morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas. And you're listening to a special training episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for October 29th, episode 1288. Good morning, Horse World.
What is your favorite day of the week?
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
Well, hi, Mary. Boy, we were delayed this month.
Yeah, this kind of turned into an unexpected odyssey. I've just really kind of got back home. I'm getting my bearings and preparing for the next big trip. But yeah, I've been taking a lot of unexpected trips lately.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about your trip up to the Northwest because, one, you chronicled it very well on your Facebook page, so we could all live through it with you. And some of the things that happened on the way home, I think we're going to spend some time talking about your trip home. But it was a lot of fun to follow you along the way. And I just want to remind new listeners, Mary is here with us usually the second Thursday of the month, but you'll hear a little bit later in the show what she was doing the second Thursday of the month, and it wasn't on here with us. So we will, that's why we're a little late this month, but normally that's when she's here. You can find all of her past episodes at horsesinthemorning.com. Just search for Mary Kitzmiller and it'll bring them all up. Well, Mary, we have a good show planned today. We're going to be you're going to be doing a training tip, and then we're speaking to Bobby Kerr about his rodeo act, which is very unique and a lot of fun. And then we have Alyssa Litwin coming on a little bit later in the show. She's preparing for which world show?
The EXCA, which is the Extreme Cowboy Racing Association.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, and that's coming up in Texas. She's going to be telling us a little bit about that. That's actually starting very soon here. I wanted to remind everybody, too, that this show is not live, and you probably figured that out already, that all the shows this week were pre-recorded because we are off on vacation. That's why there's no live ones. Live shows will be coming back next Tuesday. We'll be coming home Monday, and we'll be starting live shows next Tuesday. Matter of fact, right about now, we are heading... We're at the Grand Canyon, and then we're thinking about heading tomorrow off to Monty Roberts Farm. We'll be up at Flag Is Up Farm this weekend and looking forward to hanging out there. We've never been there before. And, of course, Debbie does the Horsemanship Radio Show with us here. So we're looking forward to seeing Debbie, and then Monty's wife, Pat, will be there. So that should be a lot of fun this weekend. And we'll be back live on Tuesday. But this is a brand new show for you with Mary. And I couldn't wait to talk to Mary because she has had this trip. Now, you went up to Central Washington State Fair, right?
Yes. They called me actually when I was getting ready to board a plane to Poland in August and said, you know, do you want to do this? And it's... unlike anything I've ever done before. It's not an expo. It's not a clinic. It's, you know, it's their state fair, and they have 200,000 people coming in and out of that thing during its run. And they have a round pen set up near all the animal barns and the livestock shows. And they usually have a horsemanship person or entertainer in there. They've had people who've worked on Hollywood films. They had the guy who did the movie Racing Stripes.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah. And he was, you know, he gave demonstrations on how to train horses for movies. They've had Julie Goodnight, Dan James, Dan Steers, you know, a lot of well-known names.
Oh, heck with all those people. This
exactly.
year, they had a real celebrity.
Exactly. I told him, you're in for a treat because... Yeah. So it was really, I jumped on it. They called me because I was going to be in the Northwest anyway, doing a clinic in Oregon. However, I had, you know, because I was just going to go in and out for one clinic, I was going to fly out. And I said, you know, let me talk to my host. I was able to arrange to where I drove out instead because the clinician really needs to have a horse or two of their own. It's a 10-day gig. So getting other people to bring their horses in for that long is going to be, you know, kind of hard to get. So I hauled out, brought Guthrie out there. And man, it was an amazing trip. It was probably one of the best trips I've taken.
Well, you did have an amazing trip out. You were taking all the pictures of you going through the mountains and everything. And you took your horse and your trailer along. So you had your truck and your trailer and your horse. And so this wasn't just fly out and do some clinics. It was you took like 4 or 5 days getting out there.
Oh, yeah. I'm a horrible traveler when it comes to being prompt and efficient and making the best of my time and staying on the road for hours. I kind of go down the road. I'm like, where can we eat lunch? Let's go there for 2 hours. So I like taking my time. So we took, I think, 4 days to get out there. And of course, this was coming off of, I haven't stopped since like the beginning of August. I went to Poland, was there for a week or two. And then I had maybe a couple days off, maybe one day off. And then I was helping clients at the Extreme Mustang Makeover. We had a booth there. And then we had one day to come home and pack and go to Oregon and then on to Washington. So really took our time going out there. You know, you don't want your horse on the trailer for hours on end. So we made sure we didn't do trips that were too daunting for Guthrie. We wanted to jump him off the trailer as often as possible. And it was wonderful. I rarely get to drive out to the West. So I really relished the chance to do this. It was really cool.
Now, do you camp in your trailer or do you stop at farms? What do you do with Guthrie then on the way?
You know, I've actually learned a lot about that on this trip. There's a great site called, I think it's horsemotelinternational.com, which...
Yeah, that sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, if you type in horse, hotel, or motel in Google, this site will be the first on your list. And it's one of the best ones. I've never had a bad experience booking someone off of that site. And usually, so up until this trip, I've relied heavily on that site, and it's usually private farms, or like training facilities, and it's always been really nice. Someone meets you there, and you know they make sure your horse is taken care of. You know, I take care of my horse, but they're, you know, it's I feel comforted on a private residence, and then there's almost always a place to plug in our RV. But we also with the living quarters on our trailer, but we also have a generator, and so I did that just about all the way out, and on the way back. The people who ran this event and surrounding this event were very heavy into rodeo. So they are really road savvy. And they said, well, just stay at fairgrounds. And so that's what I did on the way back. I kind of did half of my stops were from horse motels. And then half of them was I would just find what town we were nearing. And almost always you can pull up to fairgrounds. There's usually a number that you can call 24/7. There's a caretaker there. And so I had good experiences with that
as well. So it's like the Walmart version. Like the RVs are allowed to stay at a Walmart for free. You can pull into a fairground. I didn't know you could do that.
Typically, yes. There was one fairgrounds that I called. Going through Wyoming was the trickiest part because I guess where I wanted to stop, the college rodeo was in town. So I had more trouble booking someplace there because... I called a barn. They're like, we're full because the college rodeo is in town, which I guess was a huge deal. And the fairgrounds in that particular county, they were the one place I called that said, no, we won't let you plug in, but they would let me camp out and fire up my generator. But she couldn't guarantee me there'd be a clean stall there because of the college rodeo. So I had to stay at another place, which was, it was okay. It wasn't the best experience, but it was adequate.
Let's talk a little bit about what you were doing there. Now, what exactly did you do? You did demonstrations with your horse, Guthrie, which all the listeners of this show know who Guthrie is. But you also trained some other horses, right? You did some starting?
Yeah. So I am actually at the point in my career where I am doing this type of thing more often, where I'm booking expos. I've got a lot of cool things coming up in the calendar I can't wait to tell everybody about. So I'm currently developing, I don't want to say an act, but I'm currently developing with my own horses things to show people that are not only training, good training topics, but that are entertaining. Now, I'm still kind of starting that. So when they called me, and this was a bit last minute, I had to sort of, decide, oh, what am I going to do on the spot? So I figured, you know, Guthrie's doing some amazing things and getting stuff started. But I figured to kind of help give some variety to the demos, I would start some colts, and they have a really great source out there. There's a really nice ranch out there, really, a really good guy who, raises all these barrel horses. And the great thing about them is they're ranch raised. They're not unlike the colts that Rota the Horse uses, in that they're just kind of minimally handled. So I started two colts while I was there. And then I worked with Guthrie on some things. And then I worked a couple of other outside horses as well on different topics. It was really fun and great learning experience for me as well as the horses.
It sounds like it. And then... I was a little worried about you, though. You kept showing pictures of you there, and the way the pen was set up, it was set up that all the pictures were taken away from the stand, so I thought nobody was watching you. And I thought, she's going to be out there for 11 days, and she has nobody watching.
Yeah.
And every picture I'd see, I'd go, oh, poor Mary. She must feel terrible that nobody's watching. But you said the stands were on the other side, where all the pictures were coming from.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it actually was a concern of mine, because I knew when you go to a horse expo or you're in any kind of horse show or event, it's a pretty much guarantee that a good chunk of the crowd is into horses. They want to learn more about horses. They enjoy watching all things horses. There might be some poor horse husband there who's being drug along, but for the most part, everyone's into it. So they'll sit there and watch you do a training demo, and you're allowed to get a little bit more in depth on what you're doing. You can be a little dry. It's educational. But for a state fair, yeah, you're going to have some folks in and out that are showing livestock or appreciate livestock or into horses. But for the most part, it's people just coming to the fair. They want to
have
candy.
A lot of people there for funnel cake.
Exactly.
Right.
Deep fried Twinkies. Right. And so I was actually concerned. I'm thinking, ooh, are they going to be interested in this? And they told me at the start, you know, it's going to be a lot of in and out people. So I was totally expecting to have small crowds or people would be there for 5 minutes and walk along. And I was really pleasantly surprised. A lot of people would filter in and sit there and watch the whole thing. And I had a lot of people coming up to me who said, you know, I'm not into horses, but I thought this was really interesting. And, you know, you're my favorite part. And I think that just goes to show, you know, just working with horses is an interesting subject, no matter who you are. But yeah, so the bleachers was my mom actually took a lot of the photos, and she was working in my booth. So she's facing toward the road where there were no places to sit. But I swear on the other side, there was a bunch of people.
All right. I believe you. I believe you. Yeah. I was actually more worried about you. I was going, oh no, she's going to be so upset.
Oh no, I just do my thing, and I can listen to my own self-talk and be plenty entertained.
All right, let's talk about the way home, because that's where the true adventures began. And not everybody has the opportunity to do this on a trip. So this is through some serious mountains, people. I mean, this is mountains and mountain passes and just the most beautiful scenery you've ever seen. And you took some of the most amazing pictures. But when you were on your way home, what happened with the truck? Now, tell us, you had a pickup truck. You were hauling, what, a big gooseneck, right?
Right. So we've got our 3-horse slant, 10-foot short wall, living quarters gooseneck trailer. And normally the truck that I haul that with is a Chevy 4500. It looks like a bus. It's so big on the inside, you could have a dance party in it. And this thing hauls, when you drop that trailer
look
on the bed of that
kick
truck.
Kick-ass Mary in a 4500.
It is awesome. I love that truck. And unfortunately, it's been breaking down all summer. I think we've kind of rebuilt the engine at this point. And that truck was totally set to do this trip, but it's been in the shop and we thought we'd have it back. And of course, we didn't. So the only other truck that we had that might make it, we have a 2011 Chevy gas 2-wheel drive 2500. And it can haul the trailer just fine, typically in Texas. And we weren't too worried. We were just, you know, just take it slow. And a friend of ours actually, like, two nights before we're supposed to leave, said, "Oh, you're driving that truck? Oh, that's not going to make it." She's like, "You're not going to make it." I'm like, this is what.
Do I have a gas person, engine, like a 8-cylinder gas engine? Yeah.
Yes. And it gets like, I don't know.
2 miles to the gallon. Yeah, exactly.
7 miles to the gallon going downhill.
It gets minus 10 up the hills and the mountains.
Oh, yes, for sure. For sure. So we were going to have to stop every 6 miles. And so my friend, who's not one to mince words, is like, "You won't make it." And she said, "You know, we've been out there and it, you know, it's just not going to." I'm like, "Oh my God, what are we going to do?"
Well, have to leave tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So we made it out there fine. We took a pretty safe route on the way out. We only had one or two hills that were, the truck was screaming a little bit going up and down these mountains. And down one mountain in Wyoming, the steering column started to shake. And it turns out we were burning up our brakes. And it was a valuable lesson in don't ride your brakes down mountains. I didn't know about that. So we made it there.
You live in, let's clarify for everybody that's going, "Well, how'd she not know that?" She lives in Texas. It's flat as a pancake.
It's super flat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's like Florida. We have one hill and it's like 10 feet.
We have the quote unquote hill country, but these were, and actually I have since Googled this. Texas is home to over 40 mountain ranges, but none of them are within.
Yeah, they're all 50 feet high too. You know, it's like, it's not like the Rockies. No.
Yes. Yeah, it's, it's a different, it's
the Sierra
a different
mountains.
But so we made it there. It was fine. But on the way back, the scariest part of the whole trip, we were very careful going up. There were a few passes that, you know, just be careful. And, but we went into this Columbia River Gorge in Oregon, which is just the most breathtaking thing you will ever see. Oregon is the prettiest state in the union. I don't care what anybody says. And what I didn't realize about the gorge, when you drive into it, I mean, the road's flat and all of a sudden these cliffs are rising above you and you're following this river cutting through this gorgeous, it's a canyon. You're at the bottom of this canyon. Well, I didn't think about that because when you drive in, we didn't have to drive down into it. We were just there. Well, to go to Washington, we had to drive out of this canyon and we're driving up out of the canyon. And so for, I don't know, about 10 miles, my knuckles are white. And my mom and I, who are driving together, are just like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's still going up. It's not done." We kept going around a corner thinking, "Okay, we're going to get, it's going to get flat now." And there was still more. And so that was a little scary. And then coming back, we knew we'd have to go down that thing. So the way back, we did trade in the gray truck for a new truck.
Because that's what everybody does on a trip.
Yeah, you just trade in, just buy a new truck. What's the big deal? Just go to the truck store.
Yeah, that's right. They're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. They must have been happy to see you coming out of the blue.
Yeah. And it was kind of, you know,
do the registration? Do you just wait until you get home? How do they do it at the dealership?
You know, I actually don't know because I was teaching a private clinic during that time.
Your mom was out doing all the details. Yeah.
Yes, and she's the professional shopper. She knows how to do
all
the stuff.
So what'd you get on the way home? I know you're a Chevy girl.
Oh, so we got another Chevy, big surprise. And it's a 2015 brand spanking new diesel engine Chevy Silverado 3500, and it's a high country, which I don't know what that means, but apparently it's awesome. It's got mountains on it. So, I mean, there's mountains in the logo, so I'm going to assume this thing can drive on mountains, which it did.
Well, it is cool looking, and I'm glad you made it home. You did have a flat tire then when you got into Texas. You seem to have a thing for flat tires on your trailer.
Yes. And we actually stopped in a tire shop and had all the tires checked. And, you know, we had them look them over and said, "What do you think?" They're still.
Stop you from picking up a nail, though, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. We didn't actually pick up a nail. The thing just fell apart. And, you know, the guys that we were lucky, we noticed it at a Pilot. That we put off at, which happened to have a tire shop. Now, they weren't equipped to, like, replace a tire for us because they did semi-trucks. But they did change it for us, and so we did blow a tire.
It could have been worse. I mean, we shared an axle where the tire went across the road, across the major highway we were on. The tire came completely off and just started rolling across the highway.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we were really lucky that it was just a deflated tire. It was, we caught it in time. We were at a huge truck stop. I mean, just, and we were in Amarillo. So we're getting ready to go through some stretches of country where there wasn't going to be a lot around. So we were very lucky. So that wasn't too bad a detour.
Well, I'm glad you made it back okay and had a good time up in the Northwest, where we're going to get to our first guest.
All right, so we've got Bobby Kerr with us today, and most of you guys would know him from his now famous and viral acts from the Mustang Million and the other Mustang makeovers, where you've been incredibly successful. If you haven't seen those, just go to YouTube. It's amazing. And so lately, since the Mustang Million, you've been pretty busy. Tell us what it's been like for you since your big wins at the Mustang Million.
Well, life has just been a blessing for us. I guess because of the Mustang makeovers and the freestyle and YouTube and Gary Reynolds filming, and it caught the attention of rodeo committees and rodeo producers, and it's turned into a rodeo specialty act for me now, and that's what I do for a living. We go from rodeo to rodeo, performing what we call a Bobby Kerr Mustang act, and I've got two or three acts that I perform with, and we're at the Cow Palace in San Francisco right now, getting ready to do a performance tonight.
Wow. I have to say, I'm completely and totally jealous. And, it's funny when I go on the road and I'm talking with different people, meeting new people, and I ask them about the Mustang makeover, if they've never heard of the makeover, they've never seen anything, I can almost always say, well, do you know Bobby Kerr? And they're like, yeah, I don't know. The name sounds familiar. I'm like, he's the guy whose horse drives the car. And they're like, oh my God, it's that guy. And so you're sort of, I think you've become sort of the unofficial mascot of what the Mustangs can really do and what the makeovers are about and what makes them so unique. And what you've been able to do since then is completely well-deserved. It's very entertaining, and it's something that everyone can relate to, and everyone's either heard of it or seen it in person. So I think that's just something really special. And I have to tell you, since you've been gone from the Mustang makeovers, there's been a lot of people who've really, that's a tough act to follow, and they've tried, but no one's quite nailed it the way you have, which I just think is amazing. So people know you from that. A lot of folks know what you do with Mustangs, what you're doing on the road now. Tell us a little bit what your experience was like before getting involved with the Mustangs. What kind of work did you do with horses before that?
Oh, Lordy. When I was a kid, I was always around horses just because a gentleman up the road had a Wild West show, and I was always pulling in there and hanging around. And when I was 14, I overheard him talking about a place in Illinois where they had a lot of horses and did a lot of horse trading and hired cowboys to ride them. And so I thought that's where I needed to be. So I run away from home when I was 14 and worked for that gentleman, and then met another gentleman from Texas. And that's how I got to Texas. And then I'd go back and forth between Canada and Texas, and got married and trained horses, and I hauled shavings. I did anything I needed to do to make a living. And then I started the metal art business, and I made Western furniture and Western ranch gates and signs for 20 years, riding horses off and on in there for a while, but quit pretty much for 10 years. I didn't hardly ride at all. And then I was at a friend's place in Alabama, and they were getting ready to go to the Augusta Cutting Fraternity, and they were working the horse, and I don't know, somehow I got to work this horse, and they said, wow, you need to be riding horses. And that was Woody and Kelly Bartlett, and they give me a handlebar dock horse. I said, here you go, get going. So I started riding again, and that got me back into the horses pretty much full time again. But the furniture business went kind of south, and my son and I, he had come back from Harley Davidson mechanics school and was working at a Harley dealership and wanted to build motorcycles. So he come home, and him and I together built some custom choppers for a couple of years. And I always pinstriped and painted, and so I would go to the bike rallies and do that, believe it or not. And then that kind of petered out, and I was back to trucking. And a friend of mine, Jeff Payne, makes bits and spurs. He told me I needed to go watch this Mustang makeover. I had no idea, knew nothing about Mustangs or this program. And I kind of blew it off for a couple of years. And he bought us tickets in 2010, and we went and watched it. And I was completely blown away. And broke. And I thought, man, this is right up my alley. You know, so I parked my truck and hung my shingle out again and started riding horses, getting prepared for the Mustang deal in the spring. And you know, I got along and made some money, and I got hooked. And the next year we went back, you know, and did well and won it. And it's just started opening up doors.
Wow. And I have to confess, I knew very little of that. I didn't know you ran away from home at 14. What a really interesting history. And I mean, it kind of sounds like to me that stuff sort of led you to create this perfect storm of your act and what you do, and probably part of the reason why your freestyles are so unique and really hard to imitate.
Well, yeah, I tell everybody that everything I've done contributes to what I'm doing now. You know, up and down the road trucking, it helps us get up and down the road and to these rodeos. What I did in the metal art and the motorcycle fabrication contributes to me building my props. You know, working with the gentleman with the Wild West show when I was a kid, he was my hero. I mean, he was my Roy Rogers, and he was all about, you know, Wild West show and roping, and a good horseman, also an animal trainer. So I think like he thinks, you know, and then plus all the cutting and the roping. I even showed some halter horses and some NRHA horses back in the 70s. And, you know, so I think a little bit of everything has helped me get my horses trained and build my props and come up with freestyles that have turned into my acts. So I just feel blessed. I love where I'm at in life. And, you know, we get up and high five each other, my wife and I, every morning now. It's fantastic.
Wow, that's really cool. It's really neat. I follow what you do on Facebook, and we almost crossed paths a little while back in Pendleton, Oregon. I was heading up through the Northwest for a clinic and some stuff up there. And I was just on the outskirts of Pendleton. I was able to stop for about a minute and go into one store, and I wasn't able to see the rodeo. And that's something, you know, I'm making the same trip next year. So I'm definitely including Pendleton in my schedule. And so you've been doing entertainment at Pendleton. Was this your first year, or have you done it before?
No, it's my first year, and I've heard about Pendleton my whole life, and since I've got into the PRCA, you know, Pendleton was at the top of the bucket list, and I've always, you know, it's been going on since 1910, and I think that car act was created because of a picture I seen of a woman jumping a horse over a car at Pendleton in the 1920s, you know.
I have a copy of that picture.
You know, there you go.
Yeah.
It's just the wild, wild west. And there's no rodeo like Pendleton. I mean, it's just, It's just something to see. And it's like a 4-hour rodeo, 4 or 5 hour rodeo. You know, a lot of Indian celebrations, and they set up like 300 teepees and have since 1910 in their own area. So they're there for the festivities. The rodeo, the arena is, they play football in that infield part of the arena, which is grass when the rodeo's not on. And then there's a dirt track, a racetrack around that. And then all the seating. I mean, you just can't imagine how big that is. And there's a rail around the track, you know, when the opening comes up, the flag girls come in with the flags and jump over the rail and then go across the other side and jump over the rail and kind of crisscross to the crowd. And I mean, it's, they shoot a cannon off and say, let her buck. And then when that happens, they open the bucking chutes and they start bucking horses. I mean, and they go across the dirt onto the grass. You know, if it rains, which it did, you know, it's pretty slick. There's stuff going on. It can get real Western in a hurry. And, you know, they have a parade. Let's see, the first week there was one parade, a motorized, you know, or whatever, combo parade, which I just jumped poncho in the back of my truck and drove through the parade.
Awesome.
And then the next week, they have a non-motorized parade. And I believe that was the day you were coming through, maybe, was it?
It was. And I, as we're trying to find a parking spot, I could look down one block and I saw this parade going on, and I'm panicking. By the time, you know, I had a horse in the trailer, and by the time I got parked, that had already gone through town, and oh my gosh, I was kicking myself. But next year for sure, I'm going to make it.
I mean, they have just, I don't know if it's hundreds, I'll bet it is, of wagons and every kind of horse-drawn thing you can think of, and Indians and people horseback. And I was very honored to get to ride at the front and carry the Canadian flag. I'm Canadian born, and I rode alongside the American flag. Anyhow, we went through the whole parade, went, put my horses up, and we had a production meeting for the rodeo. And I went to the production meeting, which probably lasts, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. We come out of the meeting and look down, and the parade was still going by. That's
wow.
How long that parade is. It's incredible. And then after the rodeo at night, they have the Happy Canyon Night Show. And this show is kind of a play, a reenactment of the Northwest in that area, and it's been the same play going on for 99 years.
Wow.
And they have the, there's probably 200 people probably in this play, and, you know, they've got the Native Americans there, and they've got a drop, you know, backdrop of mountains and hills and kind of how their life was, you know, and hunting and fishing. And then Lewis and Clark come through, and the white man comes through. So this is how the play goes. It's, I don't know, it's probably a couple hours. And I got to be a part of that. And they hadn't had a falling down horse in years, apparently. And during a part of the play, the Indians have kidnapped a little white girl. And she's up on the mountain screaming, you know, and they got her tied up and whatever. And the cowboys come in here, and there's a rescue. So I would go in there shooting my guns on poncho, gallop in there, and then we would get shot, and we would just fall down and lay there. And while I was laying on the ground, they were running by and shooting, and there's a mountain. And a couple kids fall off the mountain, and there's actually a swimming pool there, like a pond. They land into the pond, and then they would pull them out of the pond and jump them on a couple horses, and they would run right by me and Poncho laying on the ground. And then another guy would fall off the mountain, get shot, and they would carry him over and lay him over Poncho. And me and Pancho would get up and take our hat off like this man is deceased, and we would carry him out of the arena.
Oh, wow.
And it was, I mean, I got to play Cowboys and Indians every night and get paid for it. It's a heck of a job.
I was looking at the pictures of the good and broke limo.
Yeah.
Did you build that?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, it's, I don't know how much y'all want to hear. I can go on.
Well, no,
on.
I was just curious if you had built it because it's so unique and so much fun. And that's the one that the horse actually gets in and sits in there with you.
Well, and yep, I have to tell you.
It's a 36 Chevrolet.
Is that what it was? I was going to ask you that, what it started out as.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to tell you, and I think I've told you this before, but I think it was, you did that in 2012, and you had had a really awesome act the year before. And then in 2012, it was my first year to make the finals at the Mustang Makeover, and I was real excited. Mm-hmm. I felt pretty confident. My horse is doing good, and I thought, okay, mm-hmm. You know. So I'm walking down to the warm up pen. This is the night of finals, getting ready to go in. I did my routine. I had a stick and my horse, and I'm walking down there, like just thinking about my game plan, and I see this giant car in the warm-up pen, and it's got a horse-sized seat in it. And I'm like, oh, heck, I'm going home. Because I knew it was yours. I'm like, I am not going, there's no way in heck I'm going to beat that. And I didn't, because it was amazing. And so that car is, and you have to see it in person. It's really cool. And the craftsmanship that goes into everything you do is just, like I said, there's a lot of people who've tried to step up their game and have done some amazing stuff, but you put just, you know, the little details you put into your stuff.
It's all about entertaining people and making them smile. Yes. Right, when the bottom line comes down to that, it's a show. And you're putting on a show.
Exactly.
Yes, you've trained a horse to get there, right? But it's still, in the end, you're putting on a show.
Yeah, you know, that whole deal's a big gamble. When I do the Mustang deal, I've already got, you know, a routine or two in my head. And when I come up with that car act, you know, I had to go buy the car. I had to build it and work on that thing all winter and then gamble, try to buy the right size horse to fit in it and gamble I can train him to do what I want to do. You know, it's all just a dream. And then,
yeah, because if you get the one that doesn't want to go in the car, you're kind of screwed.
yeah,
exactly.
You know, so from the get-go, you're molding that horse. He doesn't even know it, but you're molding that horse for that routine. You know, you're going to do 120 days later. And, you know, it's the same thing. You know, right now I'm training a pup, a dog for an act for next year, and the same things. He didn't know it, but starting at 10 weeks old, I started doing things to that dog to get him molded for what I want to do a year later, you know. So it's all a big gamble. You don't know what's going to work, and, you know, you put time and money into building these props and whatever. It's all a big gamble, but I've just been really blessed that it's worked out most of the time.
Well, and that kind of leads me to my next question, because I've seen, I think, every one of your Mustang performances live since 2011, and I've always seen that gamble pay off for you in big ways. And what you do, you know, if people haven't seen this, you know, you're jumping over the car, the horse is sitting in the car, you're jumping onto big Western towns on these huge trailers, and it's very cool and very, you know, breathtaking. Have you ever had anything, when you're doing your rodeo shows now, because you've been on the road for so long, have you ever had anything not go as planned? And then, you know, what was that like, and what'd you do to compensate?
Not really. I like to have a wreck last weekend at City of Industry. You know, Trigger, we do the saloon act a lot this year. He knows that routine. And when I come off the roof of that saloon and jump on the ground, he knows we're going to hang left and haul butt around that Coliseum or arena with the flag. And I do a lap around there with the flag. And, I mean, we're going wide open. And then I come back to my truck in the middle, and I jump over the side of the truck onto the back, and Susan's driving it, and we head out the arena. Well, I brought him in probably too hot, coming fast, and coming from Pendleton, up at Pendleton, you put mud nails or ice nails into your shoes to get some traction out there on the grass. So after I come back from Pendleton, I took a grinder and I grinded those nail heads off to be slick and have my sliding plates black back. So I think my sliding plates are even slicker than they normally are because I grinded them nail heads off. Anyhow, we hit the back of the truck and he went to sliding and couldn't get stopped.
Oops.
Hit the sideboard on the other side and it broke off and he dove over the sideboard right off the over the truck onto the ground on the other side. And I mean, it could have been a pretty bad wreck, but he was fine and he's athlete enough to handle it. And
now, were you still on board?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was just checking.
Yeah. Thank God, you know, he stayed on his feet and we just hollered and rode on out, you know.
I didn't know if you were still on the top, if you had bailed out.
No.
Boy, the crowd loved it, though. They probably had a gasp, and then they went crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I stopped and looked and made sure he was fine, you know, and I waved to the crowd. And, you know, I had a lot of people come down and make sure he was okay and then ask me the next day if he was okay. And, you know, which he was, no problem. But I stopped, and we got a new horse mat and put the rough side up, and I'm putting some slats on it right now for tonight's performance to cure that. And, you know, I've had, when I first started doing Trigger, he normally doesn't do the car act. And I think almost going out the gate, one time last year, he stood up in the car instead of staying seated. But it's not a wreck, you know. He just stood up and rode out the rest of the way. I've had a couple things that, you know, didn't go quite as planned. But most of the time, these horses, I think, love it. Poncho riding that car forever. I mean, he just kind of sits there and looks at the crowd. And
he's a smart one. He's going, I don't have to do all the work.
Well, he knows, and that's part of the training. You know, when we get in the car and sit down, we're done, and that's time to rest and ride on out. And, you know, they know the program. And, you know, that's probably the big exclamation mark of my act, and that's what gets everybody, you know, excited. But it's probably the part of the act that I'm most confident in. You know, I'm not saying he ain't ever going to get up, but he never has.
Well, we're running out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to mention the website is Bobby Kerr, BobbyKerr.net. There's an events page on there where you can go and find all the events that, well, your 2015s are wrapping up, but I assume you'll be putting up 2016 here soon.
Yep.
Plus, you have a store on there. You can buy T-shirts and different stuff and a DVD. You can get all of that on there as well. Christmas is coming. And we appreciate you being on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, y'all.
All right. BobbyKerr.net. Well, you're listening to Horses in the Morning. And yes, this is a recorded episode, but it's brand new. We are off on vacation, and that's why we're not doing live ones this week. The live ones will be back next Tuesday. But this is the Mary Kitzmiller episode for the month. Normally, she hits here the second Thursday of every month. But this month, as you heard earlier in the show, she was busy buying a new truck. So that's why she couldn't be here. But she's going to do her tip today, and I have no idea what you're talking about in your tip today. Seeking part of the brain.
Yes. So this is something that I've been playing around. This idea is I've been playing around with for the last several years. And the reason that this kind of entered into my brain to talk about today was I learned more about how I feel this works than horses in my travels, because I got to experience it in some really neat ways with some of the clinic horses I worked with, as well as some of the horses I did for my colt starting demos. And so the seeking part of the brain, This idea has come from a neuroscientist named Dr. Jack Panksepp, I believe is how you pronounce his name. And I first heard about him on an NPR show called Radio Lab when I was driving home from somewhere a million years ago. And he's most well known for the scientist who tickled rats to see if they would laugh. So that in and of itself is a really interesting story. But
this was actually a study they paid money for?
This was actually a study, and they were making this
noise. Do rats
noise.
Laugh?
They do. Well, a lot of behavioralists and neuroscientists are going to really not make a comment on it. But from my understanding, what he would do is he'd do this and the rats would make a noise, but it was such a high-pitched noise it didn't register for human ears. But when you played around with the recording, they were making this noise that actually sounded a lot like laughter. So that's a whole other can of worms. But that's where I first heard the name. And then I came across the name again when I was reading a wonderful book by Temple Grandin, who's just an amazing person. And I think the name of the book is Animals Make Us Human. Yes, it's Animals Make Us Human. And so I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of the scientific part of this. That would be for another show. But basically, what he developed is... he was able to seek out these systems in the brain based on animals' emotions. And I'm trying to find the one I'm most interested in is seeking, but they have a seeking system, a rage system, a fear system, panic. There's a pleasure or lust system. And so they've got all these parts in the brain that are triggered by different things and create different chemical reactions in the brain. So I don't want to get too academic, and that's not really my area of expertise, but this idea of the seeking system has really intrigued me for years, and a few other dog and horse trainers have touched on this as well. And basically, what this seeking system is it's the basic impulse to search, investigate, and make sense of an environment. You know, I guess like in people terms, they'll often associate it with the Christmas emotion. So think about when you are waking up on Christmas morning, especially when you're a kid and you've got all these presents to open and you're just really excited. What are you going to find? What's in there? You're pulling the wrapping paper off. You're searching for these new surprises. And those feelings that you get are driven by this part of your brain. And you can trigger this in animals. With dogs, you can play games with them where you hide treats under blankets. And the activity of them mimicking that foraging, kind of hunting, and they're looking for something, and there's the promise of something great when they get it. It creates all these wonderful emotions in their mind. It makes them open to learning. It makes them curious and confident and investigative. And I believe you can do this with horses as well. So most commonly I've seen this practiced, and I've done this myself using clicker training, because you know the way clicker training works naturally is there's a reward. You know, you try this, there's going to be a reward. So what I see with horses and what I try to explain to people is, yes, there is a reward, but what really gets the horse engaged and wanting to do the do the behaviors you're asking for, and you know, really kind of lights up all those corners of their brain, is the search for that reward. How do I get it? What do I need to do? So I've seen it in action in horses. I've clicker trained, but I've also played with it in horses where, for instance, when I'm doing a training demo, this horse has no concept of what clicker training is. I don't have time to introduce it to him. I'm usually just working with the horse in that moment. But I found that I can do things to kind of turn on, flip that switch, and get them into that seeking part of the brain, where instead of feeling panic or fear or, you know, shutting down, they are instead looking at their environment and thinking, what's that? What's this made of? Why is this making that noise? What happens if I step on it? If I can turn on that part of their brain, I have a horse who's confident, excited about what he's doing, interested in his environment. And obviously you can make the connection. If I have a horse who thinks about that, then all of a sudden the tarp is not this big, scary object. They can cross things with more confidence. They're open to learning. They feel good to be doing what they're doing.
The seeking part of the brain makes sense now.
Seeking, yes, yeah. Yes. And like I said, you know, I encourage anyone who's interested
it's
to,
sort
you
of
know,
like a teenage boy who is seeking a girl. It's, it gets the same yeah. parts of the brain going. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, or yeah. or if you're a girl, it's like, you know, if you like to shop, not all girls do, but like
it's
when
that
I
seeking,
shop for tax,
searching.
Oh my, yeah, it's not
I,
that, just
my wife gets that at the tax shop too, by the way.
Hmm? Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I leave the tax shop usually with nothing in my hands, but I love going. So why do I love going if I rarely buy anything? You know, I might buy a
It's basically the window shopping part of the brain.
Yes, where you're like, oh, what's this? What's this made out of? And that's the excitement. Shopping in and of itself, it's not just the things you're going to get. Because I could order online. But, you know, when I go to a store and I'm picking through things and I'm wondering what am I going to find? And it's kind of that same
we spent
feeling.
3 hours at the Verizon store last night with Jennifer picking out her new phone. So that there
exactly.
you go.
Exactly. That's why it's fun.
It was fun for the first hour. The next two weren't so fun. I'm just saying.
Yeah. So the idea is a really cool and exciting idea. And what I wanted to specifically talk about is how I saw it work in horses' minds when I started changing how I got horses to cross obstacles. And you know, we're talking about this a little bit on the show today with our guest, but so when I first would learn different natural horsemanship techniques on getting horses over tarps and things, you know, I'd move their shoulders and move their hips and run them in little circles and make them rest on the obstacle and work them hard away from the obstacle and yada, 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 yada. I got very good on, I could get any horse on a tarp. Any horse you hand me, I could get him on a tarp. If he's pretty well halter broke, he doesn't have to be that great. But if I can hold him on a lead rope, I can get any horse on a tarp. But the problems I was having early on in my career was I could get a horse on a tarp and it might take, you know, it might take 2 minutes, it might take half an hour, but I could get him there. But then the next day, I always felt like with my horses, I was starting over again. Or if the tarp was in a different corner of the arena, I started that process all over again. Or if it was a blue tarp and tarp, or if it was Wednesday instead of Thursday, or if it was at a show instead of at home, I always seem to be kind of fighting my more feel for horses to get on the tarp, which is fine if I'm just going to be on a trail, because if it takes me an extra 30 seconds to cross the stream, no big deal. But if I'm in a show, that costs precious time and precious points. You know, 30 seconds is way too long to get your horse to cross an obstacle. It'll be considered, you know, pretty much that the horse is refusing. They're not willingly guided. You're not going to get your points. So this really bugged me that I could not just get a horse that was confident to go where I wanted when I wanted. And what I've slowly started learning over the years, a little bit through clicker training, but also with your more traditional methods, was I could use the same methods. You know, I could still teach my horse to send forward and yield their hindquarters and move their shoulders this way and send them over obstacles. But I took the approach differently. And I saw it all come to this perfect fruition with this particular filly I was working with in Washington. And so I worked with these colts. I'd been working with them for 10 days. I'd put rides on both of them. They were all doing really good. And on the last day, the colts, they'd gone, you know, 10 days in a row without a day off. And I hadn't really felt like I overworked them. They had really great experiences. But on the last day, I was like, you know, you're fine. You've got a great start. I don't need to prove anything to anyone. Why don't we just mess with some obstacles? So I really spent time with these colts, sending them over their very first obstacles. And these are colts, they're ranch raised. They were halter broke like the day before they came to the event. And the guy was really purposeful in not desensitizing them because he didn't want to muck up, you know, what I was trying to do. So these were really, really touchy, sensitive colts. So I threw a tarp out there for this particular filly. The gelding went over fine. He was happy-go-lucky. But the filly was really, really sensitive and really watchful. And she didn't want to go over the tarp. And what I did instead of making her get on the tarp was I just worked on, can I get you to go forward? Can I get you to go straight? Can I send you up to the tarp and put your nose in the middle? That's all I really cared about because I thought she could handle that much. And I told the audience several times, I said, I can get her on the tarp. That's not a problem. The filly was really respectful. She was really willing. She was sensitive enough. If I had just whacked her hard enough with the lead rope, she would have stepped on the tarp. So, but that's not what I was trying to accomplish. What I was trying to get was to see if I could get her to flip that switch, to stop ignoring the tarp, stop being afraid, stop shutting down. Could she flip that switch and start opening up that seeking system in her brain to where she'd look at it, investigate it, you know, wonder what it's made of. Why is it making that noise? Try to put a foot on it, see what happens. If I can get that to happen, I can get any horse engaged in crossing obstacles. And so all I worked on was just would send her to the middle of the tarp and just let her stand there. And I pretty much told her, you know, you don't have to cross. I'm not going to make you. I'd like you to, you know, kind of look at it if you would, but don't worry about crossing. So I'd let her stand on it and then I'd take her away, work on something else. Or, you know, I'd let her stand right at it. She wouldn't put a foot on it. And then I'd send her around and send her to the other side. And I just kept playing around with her. And it took, well, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes. And every time she came to that tarp, I could see her just shut down. She would pretend like the tarp wasn't even in the round pen with her. She was trying to ignore it. She was just not ready for it. And I kept telling everyone, this isn't about getting her on the tarp. I could flap this flag hard enough behind her, send her onto the tarp, but that's not what I'm trying to do. And what I was looking for finally happened. All of a sudden, you know, one of the times I sent her up to the tarp, her ears just pricked forward. She looked down on it. She relaxed her jaw and I could see the wheels turning in her brain thinking, what is this made of? What is this? And when that happened, I knew I had her. She started lowering her nose, touching her nose to it. She put her toe on it to see what kind of noise it would make. You know, I wouldn't let her stay in there very long before sending her away. And then each time I brought her back up to it, that part of her brain was starting to really engage. And I think what was happening is she knew I wasn't going to make her. And that's what I told her. I said, I don't care. And I told the audience, I said, you know, if I'm here till midnight, I don't care. Because when you act like that, it's really not going to take that long, like most of the time. And so finally, she built her confidence enough and she just said, okay, I didn't have to do anything. I just stood there. She walked right across as if she'd done it 300 times in her life, you know, millions of times. And so what I'm trying to get at is when you get your horses to confront things that are usually pretty scary, see what you can do. You know, I don't have a particular method for you, but see what you can do to get them to flip that switch. And you'll know when it's coming on. If you start getting vigilant about what your horse is telling you, you'll see that switch flip. You'll see your horse go from shut down, scared, panicked to, oh, okay, well, what is this? Can I touch it? Does it make a noise? Is there a hole under it? Is it deep? Is it going to hurt me? When they start thinking their way through it instead of just shutting down, then you've got something to work with.
Very good. Well, thank you, Mary. We appreciate that. And of course, if you want to learn more about Mary and what's going on with Mary, we don't mention this enough. It's MaryKitzmiller.com. And now coming up, we have your next guest, Alyssa Litwin.
All right. So we've got a good friend of mine on today, Alyssa Litwin, and she has been preparing her horse for the EXCA World Show that's in Hamilton, Texas. And so that's the Extreme Cowboy Race Association. And I thought it'd be great to talk with her on how she's been getting her horse ready. How are you, Alyssa?
I'm doing great. How are y'all today?
Doing pretty good. You and I haven't really been doing much together since our wild and crazy trip. The last big trip I took out west, which was to California, 2000.
Project Cowgirl.
Oh my goodness. That in and of itself could make a whole show just talking about that trip.
You know, yeah, it could. Between that and how many blown tires did we have on that trip?
I want to say five. Yeah.
I think that's about right.
One was at 3 a.m. and we were in a parking lot in the middle of nowhere, and this like a Mexican truck driver came walking toward us, And I'm like, oh, what do you want? And then he just came and changed our tire for us. It was amazing. But so
we learned a pretty cool tire trick, though.
Yes, which I haven't been able to replicate. He made it look easy. I tried to have it on
video somewhere.
Yeah, awesome. I could talk about that for about an hour. But what have you been up to since then? What have you been doing with horses?
Well, I got married, so that was an adventure all in itself. So I had kind of taken a year off the year I got married, riding young horses, getting young horses going. I had, at the time when we went to California, I was working on a ranch. And since then, instead of making everybody else's horses worth money, I decided I'd take the time to really expand my realignment therapy business and start riding my own horses that had been sitting in the pasture. So did that, and I have a really neat little four-year-old that I'm going to be taking to the EXCA World Finals, and getting him ready has been a challenge and a learning experience for sure. But it's I've been really spending my time becoming a better horseman.
Well, that's never a bad thing to spend time on. Now, from what I remember, you have a really kind of interesting history with horses. I think you've done hunter jumpers, you've done barrel racing, you were Miss Rodeo Texas, if I'm not mistaken. How has that kind of, you know, different and varied background, has that really helped you prepare your horses for EXCA?
Well, you know, the rodeo queen side of things had really helped me evolve my horsemanship, and because it is kind of a traditional stereotype that rodeo queens don't know how to ride. So I really took advantage of my knowledge in the hunter jumper background, which I think gave me a good seat that I have and the balance that I have, and like to go fast, which was the barrel racing. Started riding barrel horses in high school. And when I really started to expand the horsemanship side of things was actually teaching horsemanship clinics at Texas A&M University. And I did that and decided that the lack of horsemanship that I found in barrel racing was quite appalling. So I wanted to be able to go fast, but I didn't want the horsemanship to get lost. So I found EXCA, which allowed me to still get that speed and that adrenaline rush, but I had to go through everything as fast as possible, but as correct as possible. So I took the knowledge that I had from jumping, which gave me that balance and learning how to really scope distances. And there is some jumping in EXCA with the speed that I had from barrel racing, and evolved that into kind of my own personal style that I get with EXCA, and getting those horses really, really broke, and found that when I did the Extreme Cowboy Race courses, I was able to take my young barrel horses, and I never actually had to season them, because after they've seen everything that they can see in the EXCA, they were pretty prepared to whether it go to rodeos, youth rodeos, and I could sell them to somebody that could then go and progress them in their future of barrel racing with that good solid foundation.
Well, and you know, what you said is kind of one of the reasons I find the EXCA Association real interesting, and why I wanted to talk about it. You know, with the World Show going on, it is on my mind, and it's something that I haven't been able to really get into too much yet. I've done a few here and there, and I'd like to really get into it in the future, but I like it for the same reasons you like it, is, you know, you've got, if you like speed, there's your speed event. You want to jump, there's usually some pretty hairy jumps, even for Western riders. And you know, so you've got your obstacle work, you know, there is an element of horsemanship. It's fun. It's different. It's adrenaline. And, you know, it does prepare your horse for a lot of different things. What led you to do EXCA? How did you first get involved with it?
When I, the year I had given up my title as Miss Rodeo Texas, I had met a mutual friend of ours, I believe you know, Miss Wylene Wilson. And Extreme Wylene. This was right when the association was really had started getting a kickoff, but when Craig was having all of his shows, and I was invited to be on the all-girl episode of the Extreme Cowboy Race that was held there at the Double Horn Ranch. at Craig's place. And I mean, it was so much fun. After I did the course, I was like, I have to do this again. And then saw that they were actually starting to host races, and it wasn't just on the show anymore. And so that was my first experience. And I was college rodeoing at the time. So I had two horses. I either had my college horse, who for all intent and purposes, Wrangler is not a broke horse. The whole goal of Wrangler was just not to piss him off before you made your run. But I didn't know any better when I trained him. So I had him, and then I had a three-year-old that had 60 days, my three-year-old stud. So I said, well, it'll be good for him to go. So I did the whole course on a three-year-old stud that had 60 days on him, and he did fantastic if I had ridden him correctly. I tried to ride him like a broke finished horse, and he was slightly confused. And the rush that I had doing that, I said, I've got to do more of these. The one that I had raised, I guess that was back in 2010, I believe it was. I took a three-year-old to some races, went to the World Show that was held in Topeka, Kansas. And, I mean, fell in love with it from there. And since I was the 2000 and... I think that was 2009, and I was a 2010 Extreme Cowboy Race World Champion in Craig's Shootout, which was an absolute blast, and just kept going with it. Fell in love with the sport itself, and I like to see it keep growing and get more producers here in Texas and more competitors to where we have the paybacks that some of these other big securities and big professional sports have, because I think it's something, I believe everything that EXCA stands for, and it's something that I think any horseman that is a student of the horse can benefit from.
Yeah, it is such a unique event, and you know, I don't know if I'd be offending any eventers by saying this, but to me, the EXCA is sort of the Western world's answer to eventing. You know, if you look at it from the outside, you're like, oh my gosh, those people are crazy. What are they doing? They're kamikaze. And then you realize, oh yeah, it does take some timing and horsemanship. And the few times I've dealt with it was the same for me. I kind of hit everything at a good solid Western pleasure lope. And, you know, I had like maybe 2 minutes on everyone else's time, but, so you're getting ready to do the World Show, which is the obstacle courses are, oh my gosh, they're amazing and insane and very challenging. Take us through kind of what you're doing with your horse now to get him prepared. What's kind of a typical ride on a horse that you're getting ready for the World Show?
So with my young horse, I'll be showing two horses. I've got my professional horse that I show for a client that's a stallion. He'll be shown in the pro class, and then my young horse that I will be showing in the futurity. And like any other futurity, it's 3 and 4 year olds at EXCA. And I've found that I think the hardest thing is you can do all the preparing that you can with these young horses, and you never know what day you're going to get and what you're going to get when you actually get there and what kind of horse. Trying to keep my hands slow, my legs quiet as I'm going through things, and doing a lot of going from one obstacle to another and trying to keep that mindset of preparing fast at home to where I don't scare him when I do get into the course going, okay, we got to go over here, and not getting him too frustrated or too upset by getting too quick with my hands. So I've done a lot of just going, making up miniature courses, going from one obstacle to another as if I was in a competition setting, and remembering when I'm going over something that might be challenging for him, that I just really keep looking up and look beyond where I'm going and not straight down at where I want his feet to go, right underneath me. And to push him through that obstacle and not start slamming with my feet and turning my toes out and getting my heels in him, but just to ask very quietly. And as soon as I get that forward motion that I'm asking for, is to be very solid in my releases, so my horse knows that he's done everything correctly. That's, I think, been the most challenging thing, is going from a practice standpoint to the competition. And, you know, one day he'll be perfectly fine with something, and then the next day it might try to eat him. For example, we had I was working on a drag that I had taken just a white bead sack and put cans in it so it rattled, and I've got him where I can throw this sack up and over his head, back and forth, and he's asleep, doesn't care. And then as soon as I hung that bag over the nose of my trailer, it then became a horse-eating bag. We were convinced that that bag was going to grow teeth and eat us. So since he has been eating his breakfast and dinners with that bag next to his feed sack, so I'm not real sure what it is on the ground. I can hit him on the bum with it. Doesn't bother him. But if we hang that bag that's at all elevated from the ground, it gets a little Western sometimes. So finding things that he's perfectly fine with one day, and then the next day it's the end all be all. But the biggest thing I can do too, and what I've done, is really changing my obstacles and not keeping them stagnant in the same place, because what's fine in one position, move to the other end of the arena, it's a whole another ball game. And changing colors too. I have so many different cans of spray paint. My husband thinks I have done lost my mind. Where did you spend $150 at the hardware store for dinner?
They're going to start carting you to make sure. Yeah.
You're not sniffing it.
Right? He goes, why do you need spray paint enthusiasts? Cans of spray paint. I said, well, he hasn't seen bright green and bright yellow yet. And he just shakes his head at me. I'm like, it's okay. You're pretty. Don't worry about it.
He's the trophy husband.
So changing colors and locations has been one thing, just in my, you know, where I ride, I've found has definitely really helped him, and just taking him different places, which I know, you know, Mary, you know, is riding those young horses. It's, you go someplace else and it's
a whole other,
whole nother game.
Yeah, you have to haul these things. And two of the things that you said when you're talking about how you're getting them ready really struck a chord with me, because it's something I tell my own students. You know, I was just helping a youth kid get for the Extreme Mustang Makeover, and they have to go through a trail course, which can have scary obstacles. And, you know, one is the horse goes where your eyes go. And it's really easy, whether you're leading a horse over, you're riding a horse over, whether you're going over a jump, a tarp, a bridge, whatever, for the rider to look down at the obstacle. If you look down, that's where you're going to end up. And yep.
Do you want to know something too? The same thing applies. I drive, and I was practicing obstacles with my driving pony the other day. And one of the things that's the same way, and with driving, it's actually harder, because it's much easier to look at your horse's butt. You know, you guys are looking at the ears. We are looking right at the butt. And it's so easy just to look at your horse instead of looking where you're going. But it makes a huge difference. You have to do the same thing when you're driving.
Look up between their ears. And
well, in our case, you have to look at the obstacle, because, you know, it might be to the right or the left or whatever.
Oh.
Because it might be totally 90 degrees to the right. And that's where you need to be looking, which is hard, because you're also trying in your peripheral vision to make sure your horse isn't running into something, right? So, you have to do the same thing. It applies to no matter what you're doing with horses.
Anything. It kind of reminds me, there's a really great book it's called The Art of Racing in the Rain. And it's totally not about anything we've been talking about. It's about a dog, and kind of a Zen Buddhist dog. It's a good book. It'll make sense when you read it. But the dog is talking about his owner's a race car driver. And this driver of this car has this crazy knack for being able to drive a car when it rains on the track and the track gets wet and it's very dangerous. And what he said is, the car goes where your eyes go. So that's where I get my saying, the horse goes where your eyes go. So when you're driving race cars and the track's wet and you're worried about sliding off track, losing control, when most riders take a corner, they'll look at the wall, because they're thinking in their mind, oh my gosh, I hope I don't slide into that wall.
Hit that wall.
If you look at the wall, that's where you're going. If you look ahead to the next turn, even if your car does lose control, for some reason, somehow the car always rights itself and gets out of that turn. And it's the same with the horse. If you're taking a series of jumps, look ahead to that third or fourth jump and think, we've got to get there. And when you do that, the obstacle in front of your horse suddenly, you know, even if they were spooking before, somehow the horse rights itself, takes the jump confidently, and you're off to the races. And then what you said about releasing over an obstacle, I think is really, really important. I don't think it's discussed enough in the Western world because we're not typically taking jumps, but a lot of these events now, Mustang makeovers, extreme cowboy race, you are doing some hefty obstacles. And if you can set it up to where you're not kicking your horse over the obstacle, and the horse doesn't have the experience of being kicked and prodded over, but they have the experience of when they do make that first step, they feel that release. It makes them hunt the next obstacle even better.
And I've tried to keep that pretty solid in my training and in my preparation. And every day when I end a session, I end with him standing on one of the bridges and I'll dismount there, or he'll be standing on a tarp, or he'll be I've side passed him over something and he's straddling something, and that's where I will dismount and loosen, is on an obstacle of some sort. So he hunt, like you said, he hunts that. He looks for that next spot where, okay, well, I know if I go over here, I can relax and chill there. And trying to carry that, the thought process of staying soft when you're actually competing, I think has been probably one of my most difficult, because you get in such a rush, and instead of going, okay, you look to that next obstacle and you just carry that finesse over to that obstacle. You go, oh my God, we have to go to the next obstacle, and you yank him over there. And he's like, why did you just yank me over there? All you have to do is ask. That's where it gets hard with that. When you add that speed and that, that competition standpoint is staying keeping that cool head and that maintaining that softness in the competition and not getting rushed to where your horse gets rushed is something that I've really been working on at home.
Yeah. And that's kind of one of those things that's easier said than done. I try to tell people that are going into a show, it always feels like time is ticking by faster than it really is. You know, if your horse is having trouble over an obstacle, it may feel like 5 minutes have gone by, but almost every time, if you're lucky enough to have a video of the event and you go back and watch it, this has happened to me more times than I can say, I'll feel like, man, I really took too long getting into that lead departure, or man, my horse really balked at that bridge and he was refusing forever. But then when I look at the video, usually it's way less crazy than it looked, and actually everything moved a lot faster. He didn't balk at the tarp for 5 minutes like it felt like he did. It took him just a few seconds. And if you always think, even in a speed event, I have time, just think you're better off taking your time and getting it right than rushing through that. Now you've got a refusal, so you have to go back again, which is, of course, going to cost you more time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you ever seen Whiplash, the monkey that rides the border collie?
I have.
Okay. Every time after a run, I usually feel like Whiplash. I feel like the monkey that just rode the border collie, and then I'll come out of the ring and be like, oh my God, I just rode like a monkey. And people are like, oh my God, that was the best ride ever. And I'm like, really? I was all over him. And it always feels worse than it looks. And that's one thing that I, working with some friends, I had gone out to a good friend's house the other day, and she was helping me get prepared. And I asked her just that very question, like, Does it look like he was really looking at that and saying, oh, hell no, woman, you have lost your ever-loving mind? Or did it just kind of look like he pricked his ears up and was interested? And she's like, oh, no, he just looked interested. Because to me, it felt like he came to a complete standstill and stared at it for a minute, when in reality, he just picked his head up and looked at it and kept going.
Yeah, it's funny how when we're the ones living the moment, it seems much different than
Absolutely.
Than those that are watching. We'll do a whole show here for an hour and a half, and I'll get off and say, that was the worst show ever. And we get more comments about how great the show was. It's like, oh, look what I know. Speaking
and then
of,
he decides he'll keep me around another week.
That's right.
That
then
show.
I say, oh, Mary's okay. She can stay. we have to run, though, because we're plain running out of time. Where can people find you?
I just actually relocated from College Station, Texas to Stephenville, Texas. And
Stevensville.
Yes. good old Stephenville. We're actually in between, we're south of Stephenville, in between Stephenville and Dublin. I have a Facebook page, AR Equine Services. And, you know, one thing that I have found throughout my years is a horse that doesn't hurt competes a lot better, works a lot better, and retains a lot more. So what I have also done with my training is really used my background in equine realignment therapy, chiropractic work, massage therapy, to keep my horses where they feel 100%. So I have taken that and really make sure that my horses stay sound in their back, stay sound in their muscles, and are realigned to where they want you to ride. They're not running from you in the pasture. So I had started a Facebook page a while back to promote that my realignment therapy business, AR Equine Services, again, is the name of it. And used my background with my master's degree in equine exercise physiology to have a better understanding of how muscles work, why they work, and what I can do to fix them. So I keep my horses really sound, not just in their legs, but people forget that while, yes, the legs are super important, but also we're asking them to move in ways that they're not naturally built to move. So making sure that your horses feel 100%, they'll go out and compete 100%. So if you are in the College Station, Stephenville, North Texas area, and anybody needs horses adjusted, worked on, I would really love the opportunity to help people achieve all their goals with their equine athletes. And you can find me on AR Equine Services and on Facebook.
Very good. Well, thank you, Alyssa.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a joy talking to y'all.
Well, thank you, Mary, for putting this show together and for getting all the guests together. We will be back with another Best Of episode tomorrow here on Horses in the Morning. And you can find Mary at MaryKitzmiller.com and also on Facebook, right? Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship?
Yep, absolutely.
All right, very good. Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship on Facebook. And of course, you can find all of the show notes links and things about today's guests at horsesinthemorning.com. The best way to listen to the recorded version of this show is on our app. Just go to the App Store and search for Horse Radio Network, iOS or Android. It's free, it's easy, it's simple to use. We have close to 23,000 people now that have downloaded the app. So head on over there and be one of the cool kids. And if you get a chance, stop on over to our Facebook page at Horses in the Morning and give us a like there as well. We'll see you again, I guess, in a couple of weeks, Mary, because, we'll figure out when you're going to do your show next month.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's in a couple of weeks.
I'm going to be home. So
all right, good. Second Thursday. Yeah. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, Mary.
All right, thanks.